This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up, the venerable Noam Chomsky on our climate crisis, and Nicholas Rees on the startling impacts of air pollution on babies and toddler brain development. But first, we must prevent mass climate suicide by coal. Do you think coal power is disappearing, being replaced by cleaner natural gas and renewable energy? Think again. According to data released by the International Energy Agency in 2018, coal consumption is going back up after 2 years of decline. That is terrible news for our future climate. Most of that new demand is coming from Asia. Japan and South Korea are pumping billions into new coal plant construction. Despite the good news you've heard about massive renewables in China, Chinese banks are investing tens of billions of dollars to expand coal power in many places in the world. Here to give us the big picture is Hefa Schuking. Hefa is a long-standing environmental leader in Germany and a winner of the Goldman Environmental Prize. She is managing director of the German nonprofit group Urgewald, which maintains a database of all coal projects and investors worldwide. Hefa Schuking, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
So, what does your group Urgewald's name mean in English?
Well, it's not really translatable in German. It's a word play between the two words for primary forest and primary force, like nature's force. And it works very well in German because people look at it and think, this is misspelled somehow. So they remember our name, but it's not really a good name for international purposes.
All right. Well, we want to talk about the drive to expand coal power by China and others, but let us start with your own country. From outside, we hear a lot about solar power and Danish wind sweeping into the German electricity system, but at least 35% of German power still comes from coal. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, for 2018, renewables made up 37% of Germany's electricity mix, and coal power was also at 37%.
And I read that in October 2018, about 50,000 protesters, that's quite a few people, showed up to fight off the energy company RWE. That company wants to clear-cut more ancient forest for a giant open-pit coal mine. Please tell us what is going on there.
The Hambach Forest, it's about an eighth of the forest is still left. Most of it has already been destroyed for a huge open-pit lignite mine run by RWE. The forest is about 12,000 years old. It has over 100 bird species and 10 bat species, some of them very rare species. And at a time in Germany where actually the German government has set up a commission that is debating, negotiating a coal phase-out for Germany, it seems completely crazy to destroy such a valuable and unique piece of nature when it's quite clear that Germany has to move out of coal-fired power production completely. Yeah, if you look at the situation in Europe, then 53% of Europe's emissions are due to the German and the Polish coal industry. Like, Europe's whole ability to meet its climate goals under the Paris Climate Agreement really depends on a German coal phase-out.
And to prevent horrible climate change, we know we need to get out of coal power, as you say. But according to the group Coal Exit, since the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015, the number of coal power plants in the world has continued to grow. They say new coal plants, starting up in just the last 3 years, use as much coal as, quote, all of Japan's and Russia's coal plants put together. That's an incredible number. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I do have to say the number has to be put in perspective. Like, if we were looking at the pipeline of new coal plants, 2 years ago, this pipeline was over 1,200,000 megawatts. The first time when we did this research, I mean, we were really, really frightened. Last year, that pipeline of new coal projects had gone down to 840,000 megawatts. And now the pipeline is at 670,000 megawatts. That's still not tenable. I mean, it means if all of those coal plants were built, 670,000 that have currently been announced or in some stage of planning, it would still mean that we would increase the world's coal plant fleet by 33%. But it's a little bit sort of the glass is half full, the glass is half empty situation. Actually, many, many coal plants have been scrapped over the past 2 years, but there's still just way too many out there that are either under development, have been announced, and are threatening to be built and that have to be stopped. Otherwise, we have no chance of achieving the Paris climate goal.
No country has installed more solar power or more mass transit than China. They are world leaders in alternative tech in some ways. But what is the situation with coal power in China now?
Well, China, it's really the elephant in the room, both when it comes to coal power generally, but also if we look at sort of the pipeline of new projects. I mean, China has plans for 259,000 megawatts of new coal plants. That's about a third of the coal plants that are in the pipeline globally. At the same time, the Chinese government at some point a few years ago, they announced a cap on installed coal power capacity of the country. This cap was set at something like 1,100,000 megawatts, and China is now at around 990,000 installed megawatts. That means if the pipeline of new Chinese coal plants get built, China is going to fail, basically. The stated goal of the Chinese government. There are huge conflicts in China around this question, especially in connection with the massive pollution caused by the Chinese coal industry. I mean, every year in China, over 360,000 people die prematurely due to just pollution from the coal industry. And, you know, those pollution deaths, the air pollution is something that nobody can get away from. Even the members of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party and their families are affected by this. And while there's a growing realization in China that somehow a further development of the coal industry needs to be stopped, at the same time, there's huge pressure from the provinces and from the companies in China who have been building new coal plants. And it's a difficult situation, but a lot depends. I mean, the future of our climate really depends on coming to terms with this.
Well, I think one of the ways that the United States managed to lower their emissions somewhat was by exporting some of their dirtiest industries offshore to Asia, to China in particular, things like steel production. And now I'm wondering if, due to these hundreds of thousands of deaths that you've talked about, maybe China will try to export some of the dirtiest coal production to other countries and have their production come from there instead. Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, we also see that happening. I mean, we see that the Chinese coal plant manufacturers who used to get all of their new contracts from within country, that they're now looking abroad for new contracts, and they're being supported in this venture by the Chinese government and by the Chinese banking system. And about one-sixth of Chinese-led coal plant development is actually taking place outside of China now.
Right. A Radio EcoShock listener wrote to complain to me about Chinese banks putting up money for another coal power plant in Serbia. So does your database keep track of things like that?
Yeah, exactly. In Serbia, 75% of Serbia's electricity production, it's coal-fired, mainly by lignite. And in spite of the fact that Serbia is already violating European pollution laws due to the heavy pollution load of those coal plants, There is a plan to build two further coal plants in Serbia, and this is basically a partnership between Serbia's national utility company called EPS and the China Machinery Engineering Corporation. And Chinese banks have offered to pay for the construction of the new coal plants.
In May 2017, the Global Environmental Institute, which is based in Beijing, reported that Chinese companies and banks are involved in 240 coal-fired power projects in 25 out of the 65 countries along their Belt and Road project. 54 were already under construction by 2016. First of all, Heffa, what is the Belt and Road project, briefly?
Well, it's an initiative announced by the Chinese Prime Minister Xi in 2013, and it's basically a kind of huge economic development project, but also a political strategic project of the Chinese government, and it's about developing new infrastructure, new economic zones, new transport projects in 65 countries around the world. So while it initially started mainly focused on Asia and Europe and Africa, I mean, the Belt and Road Project has now even been taken up with the goal of furthering Chinese influence in Latin America. So it's a huge political program, and what we see is that this program makes it much easier, for example, for Chinese coal plant developers to go and try and bring coal power to many African countries, for example, that do not have any installed coal-fired capacity as of yet.
A new continent to conquer for the coal power industry, and that's a pretty frightening idea. So what is the situation with coal power in India?
Well, India is also a country with the world's second largest coal plant pipeline. Over 100,000 megawatts of new coal plants are still being planned. At the same time, if we would have looked back a year ago, the pipeline would have been even much bigger. Over the past year, 24,000 megawatts of planned new coal capacity were scrapped in India. And this is mainly due to an enormous progression in renewable energy in the country. The price for renewable energy in India fell by something like 50% over the past 2 years. And that means that now building new wind and solar projects is actually 20% cheaper than even using existing coal-fired power generation.
Is there coal expansion in another country that you would like to tell us about, Heffa?
Well, for me, one of the really interesting cases is Egypt, which has the world's ninth largest coal plant pipeline. Now, if you would look back a few years ago, Egypt actually had a law against coal mining, coal power production, and even coal imports right up until 2015. This law was then scrapped under the El-Sisi regime, and what happened was that coal plant manufacturers from all over the world began flocking to Egypt to tell the Egyptian government, look, you need to build new coal plants. And so now you have a country that has not had a coal industry up to now, planning to build over 12,000 megawatts of new coal-fired power plants. I mean, this is a kind of development that's really, really frightening. As I'm myself from Germany, I see how hard it is once you have an entrenched coal industry, how hard it is to phase it out. And it seems completely crazy that a country like Egypt, which has an immense potential for renewable energy, would, you know, basically take us, instead of leapfrogging to renewable energy systems, would go to the trouble of building up a coal industry now, especially if you take into consideration the fact that Egypt does not have coal reserves of its own and is going to have to import that coal anyway. That's a crazy situation, but it's driven very much by companies from abroad. And in Egypt, for example, this is two Chinese companies, Shanghai Electric and Dongfeng Electric, which together with an Egyptian construction company will build the world's largest coal-fired power station with 6,000 megawatts.
In Egypt?
In Egypt, yeah.
The world's biggest. We're going the wrong direction.
Yeah, we're going in the wrong direction in many countries. And, I mean, we've talked a lot about China, and people are aware of China as sort of a huge problem when it comes to, you know, the expansion of coal-fired capacity. But actually, if I look at the U.S., I mean, in a lot of these projects in African countries, I run across General Electric. You have General Electric right now, who also wants to sell their equipment for coal-fired power plants, lobbying in South Africa to get the South African government, which actually already has a lot, way too much installed coal capacity, to build yet another coal-fired power station. I mean, this is one of the reasons why at Urgewald we decided it was really important to put this information out there for the finance industry to know which companies are planning to build new coal-fired power stations, because these companies are really clearly at odds with the Paris Climate Agreement and are basically working towards catastrophic climate change.
Let's make a buck by wrecking the climate. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Heffa Schucking, director of the German nonprofit group Urgewald, and they report that new coal plants are planned in many countries, promising a continuing disaster for our climate. So, Heffa, in your list of the world's top 10 developers of coal power by megawatts planned, 7 of the top 10 are Chinese companies or government-owned banks. Can people and groups outside of China have any hope of changing that?
Well, definitely, because, I mean, number one, I think it's important to say China is one-third of the world's coal plant pipeline, but two-thirds are outside of China. That's one thing to remember. The other thing is that if we look at sort of who is financing and who is investing in the top coal plant developers, then we see a pattern where Japanese and European banks, for example, are very important when it comes to direct lending to these companies. Chinese banks are very important when it comes to underwriting new bond and share issues. But when we look at who are the institutional investors who are buying the shares and bonds of these companies, actually the U.S. is the country that comes up the most. I mean, around 35% of institutional investments in coal plant developers are by U.S. institutions such as BlackRock or T. Rowe Price or Vanguard.
I note that 5 major coal companies in the United States, big corporations, have gone bankrupt in the last 3 years, yet they reorganize and mostly keep operating. It seems like it's such a high-risk industry, it still finds investors. It sounds like a bit of a Ponzi scheme. You sell all this coal power, but then you know that in the future, because people are suffering from climate change, they will cancel this industry. How does it manage to keep going?
I think the U.S. situation is a special one because basically somehow in the U.S. when companies go bankrupt, they're still allowed to keep on operating. This is different in other parts of the world, and I can't really explain to you why that is. I do not understand how companies like Peabody Energy or Arch Coal, how they can keep on operating.
So eventually, I suppose coal operators may be sued for climate damage or even human rights abuse when countries disappear. Has Urgewald tried putting pressure on insurance companies to stop covering coal plants in their construction?
Yeah, we have, together also with other with NGO partners from other European countries, and I think this has been fairly successful. I mean, the insurance companies are, as a group, I would say, much more aware of the fact that climate change is already a reality and is impacting the economy of in many different places in the world, and also directly impacting their own portfolios. And in Europe, the three largest insurance companies, which are also three of the world's largest insurance companies, Allianz, AXA, and Generali, they have all adopted policies where they ban investments in companies that are still planning to build new coal power stations, and where they have announced that they will not directly insure the construction or development of new coal power stations or coal mines.
So how can we fight to keep our pension funds and tax dollars out of climate-wrecking coal projects?
Well, I think that financial institutions, I mean, this is all relatively new, the moves by the large European insurance companies. These are things that happened in 2017 and 2018. And I think it's something that needs to be replicated in other parts of the world, such as the U.S. or Japan, where still major finances are going to the development of to companies that are developing new coal power stations. I think what we really need to see is more attention by U.S. civil society, for example, on the role of the U.S. finance industry when it comes to the global coal industry. I mean, often when I talk to environment organizations from the U.S., they're saying, but look, U.S., the coal sector in the U.S. is not doing very well. And, you know, even under the President Trump, more coal power stations are being closed simply for economic reasons. But they seem to have forgotten that actually U.S. financial institutions still play a huge role in development of coal power in other countries, because the U.S., I mean, has the largest capital markets in the world and has the largest investors in the world. So I think that that's, you know, next to solving the problem of China's government actually managing to rein in China's coal power plants at home, there's the challenge of getting the U.S. finance industry and the Japanese finance industry to rein in their financial institutions who are investing in projects that at the end of the day are going to endanger us all.
Sure. I mean, if banks were investing in heroin production directly and openly, we'd all be very upset. But here we have an industry that even in China is killing, you know, almost 500,000 people a year with their pollution. And that works in parts of Europe and parts of other countries where people are dying from this. So if we don't manage to rein in these coal plants, do you think the very worst will happen to our climate?
I don't know how the fight will go. I mean, all of the coal plants that have been announced, there's enormous opposition. There's enormous opposition in Egypt, in Kenya, in Bangladesh, in the Philippines, in Myanmar, even in China, against building new coal plants because they're polluting. They use up lots of water. Coal mining is incredibly destructive. And people realize that this is a really cost-heavy form of energy production and that there are alternatives there. So, I mean, if I look at what has happened in Myanmar, for example, also an autocratic country where it's dangerous for people to protest, but a few years ago, I mean, there were plans to build something like 5,400 megawatts of new coal plants, and there were so many local protests that 3/4 of those projects had to be scrapped. So the pipeline is now at something like, I think, 1,200 or 1,400 megawatts. And we see that happening a lot. We see the price of renewables in some places, like India, falling so rapidly that all of a sudden it just becomes completely uneconomic to build new coal plants. Like the coal plant pipeline, those 670,000 megawatts that are in there, they're not all going to be built because there's a lot of resistance. But the thing is, local resistance isn't enough. We need to change the finance industry if we want to save the climate, because it's really, you know, in 20 years, we won't have to worry about new coal-fired power stations, or even in 15 years, because the economics will be different. It's really the next 10 to 15 years that if financing goes into those projects, if projects are already, if they're ready to go online, if that money has been spent, then the danger is that they will go online. It becomes much harder to stop this development from happening. So right now, I'm not, you know, I'm trying not to think of the worst case scenario. I'm thinking, yes, we need to move forward much more quickly with the finance industry. And what I find really interesting in Europe, for example, is that Allianz, they're the world's largest insurance company, and they came out and not only said, well, we won't invest anymore in coal plant developers, they also said, we are going to completely exit all forms of coal investment and coal insurance by 2040. And we're going to do this systematically, and now we're stopping business with any company that has over 30% of their electricity production or their revenues are coal-based. We're going to take that down to 25%, and by the time in a few years, and then we're going to go down to 20, and by 2040, 0% coal business. So they've announced a full coal exit. There are a few other examples now of financial institutions who have sort of followed and done the same thing. There's the largest private asset manager in Norway, for example, Storebrand. They've said they want to completely exit coal investments by 2026 already. People need to start asking their banks and their asset managers and their pension funds, what's your date for a coal exit?
And what is the Global Coal Exit List and how can we use it?
Well, the Global Coal Exit List, it tries to really make the coal industry as a whole visible to the finance industry. Because, you know, in many cases, you know, people always talk about the coal industry and they kind of think it's, you know, very clear who belongs to it. But it's not always that simple, you know. I mean, when we were doing this research and, you know, basically putting together a list of all of the companies worldwide that operate along the thermal coal value chain, I mean, we run across companies with names like China Africa Sunlight Energy, which is actually a company that wants to build a coal-fired power station in Zimbabwe, or a company called Silver Unicorn Trading, that actually is a coal trader. I mean, it's not always obvious. And the Global Coal Exit List, it makes those companies visible. It provides basic information on the companies. It tells you exactly which companies are planning to either build new coal power stations or develop new coal mines. And our hope is that, I mean, we're already seeing that many financial institutions just who have contacted us or asking us for a full version of that database. We have a version on the net that everybody can download, that NGOs can also use or citizens can use, students can use if they want to take a look at the endowment of their university, whether it's invested in bad coal companies, and then you need to know who the coal companies are, and that's where the Global Coal Exit List comes in.
Right, and that's at coalexit.org. As we wrap up, I notice you and Urge Waldeman campaigning on all kinds of environmental issues, from climate to forest to nuclear safety. After so much activism for over 25 years, Heffa Schuking, what keeps you going?
Well, I'm always struck by the fact how a small group of people can often achieve really big things. I mean, if I think about it, Allianz is the world's largest insurance company. And when we began talking to them in 2013, they said, there's no way we're going to exclude the coal industry from our portfolio. And 5-6 years down the line, they've become a leader in terms of announcing a coal exit and excluding most of the coal industry from their investment portfolio and a commitment to fully exclude by 2040. And considering, I mean, Orgeval, we're not a huge organization. We have around 15 staff. That's the kind of stuff that keeps me going, that I see that the work we're doing makes a real difference in the world.
We have been talking with the well-known German environmentalist Heffa Schuking. She is director of the German nonprofit group Urgewald. I will put links to their site in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. For English language information about coal financing and expansion, you can check out coalswarm.org, coalswarm.org, and coalexit.org. Thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Next up, Noam Chomsky on the climate crisis.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
No one's going to be brought to The Hague, but recognizing that it would be legitimate and justified is an important way of helping people comprehend the enormity of what is happening before their eyes.
First, I want to thank you for coming. We do these scientistswarning.tv programs every day at the COP at 3 o'clock. I've been doing this for several years. My name's Stuart Scott. I'm the host for these simulated TV talk shows and coming to you live from COP24. And I'm the executive director of scientistswarning.org. So today's guest, yes, Noam Chomsky. He's professor emeritus of MIT. He's a current laureate professor at the University of Arizona. He's said to be one of the most cited scholars in history. And I believe he's the conscience of America, which right now is displaying a particular lack of conscience. And the name we're calling this program is Political Betrayal Turning into Mobilizing Action. And I want to offer a belated birthday greeting to Noam, who turned 90 on December 7th. I turned 70 on December 7th. We share a birthday. But he's got 20 years of wisdom and experience on me. And as I said, these are the answers that he gave to questions that I posed to him, and I'll read the questions to you. How do you view humanity's present situation in terms of the climate crisis and our attempts to deal with it at the UN climate negotiations?
Well, we face a very serious dilemma, stark, cruel dilemma. On the one hand, there is a severe, dire crisis. Dealing with it cannot be delayed. It's the most important issue that has arisen in human history. This generation, in fact, today's leaders and people will make a decision as to whether organized human society can survive in any decent, livable form. It's no less than that. That's one horn of the dilemma. The other horn of the dilemma is that we have to face the reality of the world. We have to find ways of reacting that are not only justified, but are also feasible and effective. So, for example, it would be entirely justified to send the most powerful person in the world, President of the United States, to The Hague for trial for severe crimes against humanity, and many lesser figures as well. That would be justified. It's not feasible. It's not effective. To choose approaches that are feasible and effective, we have to recognize the reality of the situation we face and adjust our approaches accordingly.
Then I asked him, what about the denialism that exists at the highest levels in the United States, where Donald Trump, who I, in my conversation with him, called a recognized sociopath, where Donald Trump is president?
So when the president of the United States says, I don't believe it, highly intelligent people like myself are not believers, that has an impact on much of the population, especially so when it is echoed by the people right in the next lower level. So, for example, if you look at the Republican Party primaries in 2016, every single candidate either denied that global warming is taking place or said maybe it is, but we shouldn't do anything about it, which morally speaking is much worse. They were incidentally the ones praised as the adults in the room.
Then I asked him, how about corporate executives, the business community, and the general population?
So I'm sure that the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, is well aware of the effect of using fossil fuels freely. So how is he deciding to react to that? By increasing investment in fossil fuels. We know very well about the behavior of the major fossil fuel companies over the past 40 or 50 years. It's now well known that their scientists, ExxonMobil's scientists, were in the lead in discovering the significance and the threat of catastrophic environmental global change, and were presenting paper after paper to their own managers and executives explaining the nature of the threat. And when James Hansen in 1988 made his famous speech warning the world of the threat that we are facing, ExxonMobil management reacted, namely by shifting to funding of denialism and skepticism and increasing their the use of fossil fuels. We can go on. When the New York Times, a couple of weeks ago, runs a long front page, 1,000-word article on how President Trump is opening up a vast new fields in the west of the United States for oil exploration, for fracking, they do talk a little about environmental effects, namely it might harm the interests of ranchers who want to use those lands. It was literally one phrase in 1,000 words saying that by dropping restrictions on methane, it may lead to a very dangerous gas escaping into the environment. One phrase in 1,000 words.
Now, when I spoke to Noam, we spoke for well over an hour. He was very critical of the mainstream press for downplaying or underrepresenting the words climate change in their reporting of various things going on.
And all of this has an effect on the population. People listen, they see. They see that nobody seems to be taking it seriously. We see the results in polls among Republicans. Fully half of Republicans literally deny that global warming is taking place. Now, that includes people whose livelihoods are being destroyed by long droughts that are wiping out their sources of fish, of food, and so on. Say, no, it's not happening. That's half of Republicans. Of the other half, barely half say humans may be responsible. After all, if the man in charge says highly intelligent people like me don't believe it, who am I to question it? These are some of the realities we have to face.
Our governments are not telling us the truth, quite simply. They're not saying how severe the consequences are. They're hiding behind, it's always 10 years off or 12 years off, or the goal is by 2050. And he was very critical in general of governments, how they are not preparing people for the kinds of changes. So then I asked him, what would be the most effective approach to the task ahead of us, out of addressing this dire threat?
The effective approach is not simply to say, look, there's a dire emergency, you have to change everything you do. That's not going to work. What has to be done is to approach people, explaining that the situation is serious, is likely to be catastrophic unless we do something, and then go on to show what in fact is true, that efforts to deal with it are within range and will in fact make your life better. They're not going to destroy your life. We'd be much better off living in a green economy. You'd be much better off not spending 3 hours a day fighting traffic jams if you had an efficient mass transportation system. You'd be better off if you didn't have to take your kids to the doctor because they're suffering asthma because they can't breathe the air. If we had potable water, yes, things would be better. If we had an environment in which people could survive and live decent lives, everyone would be better, and it is within reach. There are things that we can do. There are things that are being done. Those are the kinds of approaches that have to be taken, and it has to be done. It's a difficult choice, because on the one hand, you recognize the enormous character of the catastrophe that's impending. On the other hand, you have to mute your responses to address the reality of the world in which you're trying to make a change. A hard decision. Often in many activist endeavors, these questions arise. It has to be managed and quickly. It's some of the things that are happening are almost beyond description. I'll just mention what may be the most evil document that has ever appeared in human history, which was barely mentioned in the news. Naturally, it's from a bureaucracy, Trump's National Highway Administration bureaucracy. It came out with a big study, a couple hundred pages a few weeks ago, concluding, explaining why all regulations on automotive emissions have to be ended. No regulations, free emissions. And they had a very rational argument. They said, if we extrapolate from what is happening now, by the end of the century, it will essentially be over the cliff. The temperature will have risen 3 or 4 degrees centigrade. Sea level will be very high. They radically underestimated it. People will be fleeing the coastal zones. It's all over. And emissions don't really contribute that much to it, so why not enjoy it while we can? The underlying assumption, of course, is everyone in the world is as criminally insane as we are, and nobody's going to do anything about it. That's the human species. So fine, let's rob while the planet burns, putting poor Nero in the shadows. He only fiddled while Rome burns. That's the world that we face, and we have to understand it, deal with it, grit our teeth, approach the problems constructively, effectively, and in a way that is feasible, suppressing the justified feeling that we should be taking extremely dire actions. Now, that is not to say that we should not be doing those things. Major dramatic actions are very much in order. Efforts to create a general strike, regular massive protests. All of these things are important. They have to be shaped and geared so that they, instead of being offensive to people, they energize and mobilize them. That's the way they have to be developed, organized, and run. There's a range of activities that can be important, that can be done, from talking to your neighbor to installing LED lights, to political action, to demonstrating, to bringing the dire character of the existing circumstances to general understanding. All of these things are within range. There can be no delay in executing them. These are the most significant questions that the human species has ever faced, and the record shows that it can succeed. We don't have a lot of time. This has to be done effectively, quickly, with careful thought. Actions like Extinction Rebellion, the teacher strike, Earth strike, aiming for a general strike, all of these things can be in parallel with efforts to simply introduce legislation to improve renewable energy, to cut back sharply on the use of fossil fuels, to end the insane expansion of fossil fuel exploration and lifting of fuels. All of that has to be done at the same time. No one's going to be brought to The Hague, but recognizing that it would be legitimate and justified is an important way of helping people comprehend the enormity of what is happening before their eyes. We should always bear in mind the slogan that Antonio Gramsci made famous. We should have pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will. It's never been more important than it is now.
Pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will. We have to act decisively and quickly. That's why we're here. Help us organize against this existential threat to life on Earth at scientistswarning.org. And my name is Stuart Scott. Thank you very much.
My thanks to Stuart Scott from scientistswarning.org for that conversation with 90-year-old Noam Chomsky. We just have time for part of my talk with Nicholas Reese from UNICEF. Danger in the air, how air pollution can affect brain development in young children. That is from UNICEF, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. We have Nicholas Reese on the line, the policy advocacy specialist who wrote the report. Nicholas, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be here.
You put out this report from UNICEF at the end of 2017, I believe, but the public still doesn't know that our exhaust pipe gas can hurt babies' brains in ways that could damage them for life, and that seems very serious. Is that based on relatively new science coming out behind this report?
Yeah, it's based on this, on a really a growing body of science on this. But it isn't all just absolutely new. I mean, we knew that when air pollution had lead in it, for example, in many parts of the world through the 70s and early 80s, we knew about it then. And the public and policymakers acted decisively when they found out the negative implications of lead in the air and in gasoline and how it could affect children's brains. More and more research now is surfacing over the last few years about how other types of pollutants, including a lot of the air pollution that we breathe now, could also actually have implications for children's cognitive development as well. And so it is a growing body of evidence, and it is increasingly, we're seeing more and more research coming out on this. And I think it's just a matter of time before we begin to ask ourselves the same questions that we asked ourselves in the past, is, okay, enough is enough. This is pretty horrible, and we have to stop the negative implications of air pollution on children's brains.
Well, you've got three clear pathways of how this can get into our brains in your report, and I'd like to just take them step by step. And the first is something called neuroinflammation. Could you tell us what that is and why that has anything to do with air pollution?
Basically, a lot of the particles, the most dangerous of air pollution particles are the really, really small ones. These are measured at 2.5 microns in diameter, to give you a sense, about a 30th of the width of a human hair in size. So it's extremely small. It's these really small particles that enter the lungs. And because they're so small, they can also enter the bloodstream and travel up to the brain, where studies are showing that these really small particles can damage the blood-brain barrier, which is essentially a thin, delicate membrane that protects the brain from toxic substances. So, and then in this damage can cause this neuroinflammation. Studies are also pointing to the effects of that neuroinflammation on impaired cognitive development and also even linking it to diseases that affect older populations, such as Alzheimer's.
And the second route for smog to get to the brain really seemed strange to me. It appears that pollution can reach our brains directly through our nose. How does that work?
That's through the olfactory nerve that's basically located just very close to the brain and through the nasal passage. If certain substances can get through that dimension, and studies are showing that it can reach the brain through that passageway as well.
And I had to look up one of the substances mentioned in the report, magnetite, the most magnetic material on Earth, and then how nanoparticles, as you described, very small particles of magnetite can work in the brain. So I go on to Google, and the first search shows that there's optimism that drugs could be injected with magnetite, and that would allow doctors to steer medicine to specific spots with a magnet. But according to your report, there's also a real downside of having more and more tiny magnetic bits entering our brains. And it looks like they come even from the operation of the motors in our cars and trucks. How do we know that the magnetite from pollution getting into our heads is from those sources, those industrial sources, rather than the natural magnetite that is found on Earth?
Well, a lot of studies have looked at areas where magnetite is highly present in the air, in urban environments where there's a lot of traffic and where there's a lot of industrial pollution. They've demonstrated that populations in those who are exposed to the air in those areas have higher concentrations of magnetite in their body. And this basically creates oxidative stress in some similar ways that, as I was describing earlier, with lead. These are heavy metals in the air. They have similar effects on brain tissue and neurodegeneration.
The third pollutant that's mentioned in the report there I know pretty well. In the early 1990s, I researched polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. I know that fossil fuel combustion produces PAHs, and so, by the way, do forest fires. But is there a way to describe to a general audience what these substances are?
It's a specific class of pollutant, and it is mostly linked with automobile traffic. Just taking a quick step back here, pollution is a very tricky thing to evaluate the effects of because there are so many different types of particles. There's, as you say, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, there's magnetite, and then there's even just particulate matter that is not necessarily, it's just very, very, very small. So there's so many different types of pollutants, and it's very hard. One of the big challenges here, and also I think why we're seeing such a growing body of research on the link between air pollution and brain development, has been trying to disentangle how different types of pollutants affect people in different ways. And now the science is getting better and better, and our methods are getting better and better, and the technology is getting better and better, which is allowing us to disentangle the effects of certain types of pollutants. So as we mentioned, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are a particular type of pollution. It's really just one of the PM2.5s, which is really just referring to a size of particle. It's a specific type of pollutant, which is really comes from a lot of the fossil fuel combustion and, you know, essentially fossil fuel combustion and industrial pollution. So, you know, I think one of the big challenges has been disentangling these, but now we're starting to be able to do it. And studies are showing with polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that it's contributing to a loss of white matter in the brain. And white matter essentially contains nerve fibers that are critical for helping neurons in one part of the brain communicate with neurons in other parts of the brain. And it's this communication and the rapid level of communication that allows brains to develop and form, especially in very, very young children.
Right. The first, what is it, 3 months of a child's life, of a baby's life, is the most critical for the formation of the brain. Is that right?
Absolutely. Those first 1,000 days are absolutely critical to a child's future. During that time, it's essentially a critical window of brain development where neural connections are made, and then those neural connections replicate over and over throughout a child's life. And so disruptions during those first 1,000 days can have long-lasting effects on a child's brain development.
Where are the most people being affected by the worst air?
What we did was we looked at some NASA maps that measure air pollution annually around the world. And as one can expect, the highest levels of air pollution we're seeing in South Asia and East Asia. And that includes extremely high levels of numbers of kids affected. But I do want to just point out, though, that is outdoor air pollution. And there are huge numbers of kids living in other parts of the world where solid fuels are burned inside homes. And so that does not account for the levels of exposure that young kids might be exposed to, and parents as well, who are living in homes where solid fuels are used for cooking and heating. And the levels of air pollution in the kitchen, for example, can be just as high, if not even higher, than some of the most polluted cities in the world. And so we really have to, when we think about air pollution, it's obviously, there are some of the cities in the world where pollution is really high a lot of the time, and that needs to be addressed. But we also need to think about the microenvironment where children live and their exposure to indoor cooking in a way that where improper ventilation prevents air pollution from escaping the room where a kid may be.
And then we have another new study published in August 2018, this one by Chinese academics, and the title is The Impact of Exposure to Air Pollution on Cognitive Performance. And as a writer named Kevin Loria said in the World Economic Forum, this study found, and I'll quote him here, chronic exposure to air pollution appears to cause detrimental effects on cognition that get worse throughout life, potentially increasing risk factors for degenerative diseases like dementia and Alzheimer's. And that's basically what you were finding in your report, is it not?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, and this is yet another, and, you know, we published this report about a year ago, but it was since then we've just seen studies like these more and more coming out, which are pointing to these links between air pollution and cognitive development. And this is very much in line with the growth of literature that we're seeing on this topic. And so, as I said at the beginning, you know, at what point is enough enough? At what point do we have to say this is posing a considerable risk to our children and their futures and their ability to learn and reach their full potential? And at what point are we going to say that we need to really do something about this? You know, air pollution has made a lot of links between high levels of exposure and risks to child survival. We've known this for a long time. We're increasingly seeing this growing body of evidence affecting their potential learning and so forth. We're not going to be successful in preventing child death and improving their potential in the future if we don't address environmental risks.
I totally agree, but I do see this caution that isn't your report talking about an increasing percentage of damaged kids rather than all kids? I mean, pollution, does it hurt everyone, or can we still see a lot of healthy people and very intelligent people coming from highly polluted areas?
There's growing body of evidence that it is affecting the full performance or the full potential of brain development. That's not to say that you're not going to get very smart kids growing up in potentially highly polluted areas. That's definitely, but the risks are there, and everyone from parents to policymakers need to know those risks and to do what they can to prevent exposure. You know, we're not saying leave the city, but you can do what you can to prevent exposure even if you live in highly polluted cities. Make sure that even planning when you travel during the day can help reduce exposure when you're outside at high levels of pollution.
And we've been talking about a report, Danger in the Air, How Air Pollution Can Affect Brain Development in Young Children. You can find links for this free report and the science behind it in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Once again, we are all out of time. Tune in again next week for more Radio EcoShock.